The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Amanda Wasilewski is an artist and lecturer in media studies at the University of Amsterdam. She's also the author of Made in Brooklyn, a book that was published by Zero in June of last year, and she's the guest on this week's podcast. It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week's podcast is free to everyone, and this week's Symptomatic Redness will be available to our Patreon supporters. Patreon subscribers get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. If you're listening for free, you'll always be able to access one or the other podcast each week. I hope you enjoy them. The music you're listening to right now is Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, covered on the ukulele by the YouTube star Sunga Jung. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Amanda Wasilewski and I discuss her book, Made in Brooklyn. Amanda Wasilewski is an artist and lecturer in media studies at the University of Amsterdam. She is a doctoral candidate in art history at the Graduate Center of CUNY and has previously taught at Lehman College and Spitzer School of Architecture at City College in New York. She is also the author of the book Made in Brooklyn, which came out from Zero Books in June of this year. So what is Made in Brooklyn about? And then I guess also, what is the maker movement?
The book, the idea of the book really started from my own experience living in this particular neighborhood in Brooklyn, where I had just moved to New York fairly recently, having spent quite a lot of time as a practicing artist in Amsterdam and London. And one thing I noticed when I joined a studio in the neighborhood was that instead of being a traditional art studio, it was calling itself a makerspace. So I was interested. I had heard things about the maker movement, but I was interested in how it had changed not only artistic practice or the way that artists practice, but also how it was changing the neighborhood and how that ethos that I saw in that art studio was changing how artists work. So a makerspace is, or sometimes it's called an incubator, or sometimes it's called a co-working space, are spaces where usually it sort of comes from the tech industry and hacker culture, where there are spaces where you share tools or equipment and you create different kinds of things. So with the hacker space, it would have been robotics, but it can easily be other kinds of things. So often it's associated with things like 3D printing and laser cutters. So it's sort of computer-aided making. So you can kind of share plans to make things and produce them in these maker spaces as either as a hobby or as a small business.
Now, you were coming to this maker space, which I guess was the first time you encountered it, as a working artist or someone who was coming out of art school?
Yeah. So as a working artist, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I came from a pretty, I guess, I mean, the kind of work I make is video and installation. So it has to do with media. So I thought this might be an interesting opportunity to be with other media artists. But when I was there, I found that the model was very different than what I was used to. And also the way that artists work was out of necessity very different. So there was a far more entrepreneurial kind of attitude coming from artists. because, you know, out of necessity, because they had to make money and alongside having their own artistic practice. So I was sort of interested in that entrepreneurship, and also it kind of feeds into a lot of the cliches about that particular neighborhood, which I call Morgantown in the book, but which it's an industrial area north of Bushwick. And it's associated with hipsters as a kind of negative, so that, you know, hipsters who like, you know, niche products, craft beers, those sort of things. But I saw how those tastes come out of the same attitudes that the idea to make things, either in the tech industry sense or, you know, from a 3D printer, or even, you know, the kind of popularity of knitting and stuff like that. I saw how those inclinations kind of went across the culture in the neighborhood as well. So that's how I kind of expanded what I was thinking about just the maker movement to thinking about, you know, what is a hipster? What does that mean when we use that term? Why is that a negative? What are the negative connotations there? You know, and the first is obviously, you know, gentrification, which everyone in New York is incredibly concerned about. So that's kind of where it all came together.
When I was growing up as a kid in Colorado, I lived across the street from an artist who made sculptures named Michael Garman. And it was like a little suburban area in Colorado Springs. Actually, not. It's really pretty close to downtown, but it was a little neighborhood. And he created sculptures that were meant to be sold to the public. It was not. He didn't end up in museums. He wasn't looking for recognition from the New York scene, but his work was sold in airports. And he had like a little factory in old Colorado City, like in the historic district of Colorado Springs. And so like he'd get these young art students in and they would actually make the work. He would design it, you know, and they'd make these little cowboys in working class neighborhoods. It was kitsch, but he made quite a lot of money. He was a millionaire. So I'm wondering, when I hear about entrepreneurial artists, I think about that. I think about Michael Garman and how he was aiming to create art products that were aimed at consumers rather than create art that would be put into like the museum system or the gallery system or something like that.
And I think, you know, on a different level, artists like Jeff Koons or Damien Hirst were, you know, sort of not respected by the intellectual sphere of the art world, but still make some of the most valuable art around work in actually that way. But what I see is different about this particular phenomenon that I discuss in the book is the kind of influence of startup culture and in particularly internet startup culture, and how people are, there's a strong inclination to promote what you're doing online, go viral, have an online network of people who are interested in similar type things, and to have this kind of global outreach from the local scenario. So I think that might be the difference that I'm looking at, is because for the maker movement, you know, some of the people who the sort of advocates are very excited about the idea that, you know, I can make this plan, I can share it online, and people anywhere can then print it off on their 3D printer or, you know, use the design for their laser cutter or whatever. So I think it's that the idea of having that internet connected network is different than the older model of even, you know, the kind of artist who was entrepreneurial in the past.
So are they still aiming at the gallery system with their work? I mean, is the idea to get grants and to play that system, or are they trying to sell directly to consumers?
I think it's kind of a mix. I mean, from my experience with the maker space or the co-working space I was part of, a lot of the people there were doing their own projects that I assume they would like to show in a gallery setting, but also doing a lot of commercial commission projects, which might overlap with their interests, but that they were getting a kind of commission to, for example, do a display for the Lacoste store window or that sort of thing, or do a projection on the side of a new condominium complex that was just opening, or yeah, so that kind of thing. So yeah, I think it's a mix, but the kind of thread through it is a desire to go directly to the public, if not the buyer, you know, to be known as an artist, not just by a select group of people, but to, you know, maybe have YouTube videos and have a community based online or Instagram or things like that.
You know, that is the model that we're using at Zero Books. Really.
We have
a YouTube video. We have this podcast. We put out books by a bunch of different people, and they're great. It's a way of getting a network together and creating an impression online. We even have a Patreon to fund our online content.
Yeah,
Seems like it's the model for content creators today, whether you're artists or writers or what have you.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But it's different in Brooklyn, right? I mean, it's got a whole different aspect.
In the book, I look at the history of quote unquote artist neighborhoods in New York, and because I had a feeling, or my sense was that this was somehow different, even though it's still known as like an artsy creative neighborhood. There's something different. And I think that different thing is that we have social media, we have these different ways of promoting yourself. So artist neighborhoods in the past were fairly insular. They were little, you know, subcultures that, you know, maybe they would have gallery connections elsewhere, but they were very inward looking. Whereas I think Bushwick or Morgantown has been more outward looking from the beginning when artists first started moving in there. So, and I think that is hugely influenced by all the social media venues you can, you know, share and promote your work.
It's interesting that they would be more outward looking because of the internet. You would think that would maybe even give people the opportunity not to congregate together in real space, right? I mean, that you wouldn't need to have a neighborhood that was associated with artists because they could work together in a networked way online, and also they could seek out cheap rent anywhere in the country or even the world to and still create their work. But in fact, there was a neighborhood that arose around this kind of networked, internet-focused, outwardly inclined maker movement.
Yeah, and it's sort of a paradox that, you know, you would think, and so I do think the local scene is still relatively important, but of course it's changed significantly as well. So for example, in Wicker Park, which was an artist neighborhood in Chicago, there was a famous coffee shop in the late 80s called Urbis Orbis that it was a meeting place where lots of people just would go and hang out and run into people. Today, it seems like a lot of people maybe connect or run into each other on Twitter or Instagram, but maybe they'll still want to be, you know, meet up in these common spaces to connect in the kind of local places. And also there's definitely a kind of cachet that these places become more famous and therefore more desirable to live nearby, and the restaurants, bars, those sort of things in these neighborhoods.
Right. If you're creating your brand, it's good to be able to take photographs of yourself, some selfies where you're, you know, in the right locale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm older than you by probably quite a bit, I'm guessing here, and because I'm like 47, which means that I came up and, you know, my 20s were the 90s.
Yeah.
And back then I published a zine for a while, and I wrote for zines and things like that. What do you think the connection is between today's maker movement in Brooklyn and the old do-it-yourself zine culture of the 90s?
Well, I think that like there's a really strong connection. Actually, in my my most recent research project is actually about sort of DIY culture in the punk scene of Amsterdam in the 80s. So I do see a lot of parallels. I think it's sort of the contemporary manifestation of that is kind of turbocharged in a way, because it's, again, it has such a wider reach, whatever you're making, you know, things like Etsy, where before, if you were a person making crafts or jewelry, you know, you might go to like a craft fair and sell your stuff there. But now, you know, anyone in the world can find your Etsy page. So I think it's sort of turbocharged that. And as a result, I think as well, it's made it the idea of being an entrepreneur in that sense, a kind of craft startup person, for instance, brewing your own beer or making artisanal, like, you know, food products or those sorts of things. It's easier somehow to do, but that leads to the kind of accusations of, you know, people being hipsters. All they want is this kind of, you know, avocado toast and flavored mayonnaise and these special brands of hot sauce or whatever the trendy product is.
Yeah, but, you know, avocado toast is like really tasty.
I know. I like it.
I'm not so sure about flavored mayonnaise, but you know, I'm on down with the avocado toast and even the like specialty hot sauce. That's cool stuff. So, but yeah, I see what you're saying. And also it's interesting that, you know, we moved in just one question from art production to straight up consumption, just, you know, running a restaurant.
Yeah.
And did you see people make that move themselves?
Yeah, 100%. And that was something that's really interesting. There's a famous pizza place in the Morgantown area right next to Morgan Avenue subway station that is called Roberto's. And, you know, it's become a destination. So lots of people who live all over New York are familiar with Roberto's and have been there. But that started out as a group of guys who went to art school, or they're musicians. You know, they were kind of living in the neighborhood doing the artist thing. And then thought, oh, well, wouldn't it be fun to start, a really, you know, cool, very, you know, authentic pizza place. So they kind of rented out a shed, which is very unimpressive, a kind of just garage basically, and brought in this pizza oven, and then became a kind of phenomenon where they were hugely successful and just, you know, obviously didn't continue playing music or whatever they're doing before, but instead became sort of famous entrepreneurial chefs, and they started, you know, wanted to expand. And then they ultimately had a kind of falling out amongst the guys who started it. So that kind of thing happened. And one of the things I was interested in was how a lot of the artists who came to that industrial area around 1999, 2000, the first ones, and a lot of them had been recently sort of pushed out of Williamsburg. Williamsburg was getting expensive. And they came to that neighborhood thinking, okay, we're not going to get pushed out again. So how can we set our roots and make a business here and something that we'll enjoy doing as well? And so it wasn't kind of the straight up dream of having cheap, affordable space and doing your art or your music or your dance. It was, how can we rethink how we're doing this? How can we maybe make sure that we can do what we want to do and not be displaced in another 10 years? So that's something I think was really interesting.
Well, back in the 90s, there was a guy named Trey Shannon in Portland, and he ran the X-Ray Cafe, which was a place for punk music and, you know, grunge music. And he had his own band called the Kurtz Project. And the whole idea was that the drummer didn't know how to play. And so they formed a band. And then as he, you know, basically they formed a band to perform in public, and he would learn how to play as they went to gigs. And when he could play the drums well, they would quit. And that's what they did. You know, he ran for mayor at one point, Trey did. But, you know, sort of a lark. And he was just sort of a figure in Portland, and Portland's small enough that you can do that. And now he is the owner of Voodoo Donuts.
Oh, right. I've heard of that.
Right. So he comes out of the grunge scene.
Yeah.
As an artist,
really, some kind or another, and a performance artist is what I would say he was, and an organizer. And now he's a very successful entrepreneur for Voodoo Donuts. So this is a trajectory for certain people. But it seems to me you have to sort of be born into a certain class to make that work. Like, he had connections from the start in town. It's kind of my feeling. Yeah, but I'm not sure about that.
Tell you all, you people are just lucky people tonight. I feel lucky. How about you, huh? Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Tahoe Jackson.
I kind of talk about it in my book that, of course, the sort of the majority of the people who are going to art school in general are from middle class backgrounds anyway. So they're going to have a kind of leg up. But there were a few cases of people sort of younger people whose families, like Latino people whose families had lived in the neighborhood, you know, trying to kind of capitalize on opening a business that, you know, would appeal to the new hipster crowd. So, you know, juice bars and stuff like that there. So that's not, I kind of wanted to emphasize that the people who live in the neighborhood already or the people who grew up there are not totally excluded from this sort of phenomenon. But yeah, there's definitely a semblance of privilege that facilitates, you know, doing these kind of ventures, starting a business in that kind of way,
There is a political radicalism that's runs through the maker movement, it seems to me. There's something like – there's some notion of a post-scarcity society.
Yeah, and I think it's a – it's a little bit – it's very utopian, and I think it's worthwhile to think about how – with the pitfalls of that, perhaps the sort of there's a kind of idea that runs through a lot of the Silicon Valley literature that, you know, now you have the means of production in your hands, which isn't completely true. It isn't completely not true either. But, you know, it does facilitate more people having more access to things in a certain way. But then there's also on the other side, this kind of mandate that you will use all of your free time doing freelance labor. So in that way, it's not the liberation that they promise. This kind of the idea that we'll get rid of factory production and we'll all produce our own goods at home is, I think, not quite what the trajectory of this sort of movement is, as I go into a bit in the book as well.
You start out making something, maybe good pizza that you distribute, you know, in your co-op or something, or like in your little maker space. You start cooking your own food, and then that becomes a small business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, walk me through how you go from this post-scarcity utopian vision to the entrepreneurial vision, if you can.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the product, of course, but there's like a lot of cases where you develop a product in a makerspace, whatever that product is, and you've made a prototype, and then your next step is crowdfunding. So then you go to Kickstarter or whatever platform and you get people to contribute money for that product without any guarantee that it will work. And then at some point, so this is where it kind of breaks down, because up until then, the maker movement idea kind of scans. But at that point that you have the funding or secured funding from people, then you need to try to produce it on scale. And what happens, even in the maker movement, they call them maker pros. They end up actually getting their products manufactured in China a lot of the time. So they have this great idea that, oh, we're all going to be producing these products in our own home. And then ultimately they go the traditional, you know, large scale factory labor route if they're successful. So that, I think, is one of the kind of that's how one method of distribution flows. Of course, there's still like the you know, the very niche products like the mayonnaise, fancy flavored mayonnaise, which becomes a luxury product, you know, $10 a jar or something. And that can be produced locally, but on a small scale and, you know, publicized as a kind of luxury niche product. So yeah, I think there's a number of different trajectories that it goes, but I question some of the utopian promises that the maker movement seems to suggest, because I think in reality they don't really come to fruition.
When you got into the art world, when you started out as an artist, what was your vision for what you would do with your art?
Yeah, I mean, I always kind of struggled with that personally, actually, because I was always a bit cynical, and I wasn't very much interested in making more stuff, like just stuff for people to buy and put on a wall. And so, you know, I got into doing things like performances or installations and videos, which are, you know, fairly ephemeral, because of that inclination personally. But then of course, to succeed in the art world, you do need to show stuff, you do need to sell stuff. And so it becomes this kind of game in the art world where people pretend like we don't care about money, but everyone cares about money. So, it's an interesting thing.
Back in the 60s, though, that there was that turn towards conceptual art, and part of it was in order to break away from the physicality of the art object as an aesthetic object, which then would enter the market and be a site of basically financial investment.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, but then, of course, it sort of gets commodified in other ways. So that kind of gesture of avoiding commodity, you know, ends up being... Yeah, you buy a certificate or, you know, other, like a photograph or whatever, those sort of things. Even performances, buying tapes of performances and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I know about the conceptual art movement because I have a fairly expensive book documenting color and black and white photos, right?
Yeah.
So you were, but you had that inclination to avoid being commodified as an artist.
Yeah, I think, and that's always been one of my struggles because, I romantically got into art for the ideas side of it. And so, yeah, the actual practical aspects of it were less appealing, the kind of self-promotional, work you have to do and trying to package your work in such a way that somebody will want to buy it, that sort of stuff. I was always a little bit ambivalent about it, I guess.
did you want to be famous?
I don't know, like not famous. I guess
I understand, but
yeah, I mean, I would have.
How about significant?
Yeah, no, I think everyone does.
Right. I mean, when I was a young man, I'm still in Portland, but when I was a young man in Portland doing that zine, my goal was twofold. One is to create works of art that would help bring on the revolution.
Yeah.
And the other was to become the great American novelist and to be extremely significant.
Yeah.
Famous would be part of that, right? But
yeah.
with the right people, you know, like to yeah. be remembered and all that kind of thing. I
yeah.
think that that's just at the base of wanting to be an artist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure. Leaving something that people appreciate in your wake or behind you. Yeah, no, that's definitely part of it.
And getting social recognition from your peers while you're alive is also pretty nice.
Yeah. yeah, definitely. yeah.
Right. So it's this weird position that the artist is in. On the one hand, they maybe see through society a bit.
Yeah.
And want to get beyond it. On the other hand, they want that society's recognition and a place within it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, especially with the way that the art market is today, it's kind of this vast, unregulated monstrosity that, you know, it's even worse than it ever was before in terms of kind of this, how you can be cynical about the way the market influences art prices and what art is valued and what art ends up in museums. So, but then, you know, you could sit back and be cynical and say, well, you know, it's all BS, or you can participate in it, or you can do this third way. It's the kind of the self-promotional route. And that's where I think, you know, people feel empowered by that because, okay, a fancy gallery won't show my work. Well, I got all these followers on Twitter or Instagram who love my work. So I think, yeah, that in a way I can see how that's an appealing third option.
Well, you're in your book, you wrote a bit about how all of this sort of was lifted from the Romantic tradition.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the slogan from 1968, "All power to the imagination."
Mm-hmm.
Which I found really interesting that 68 was brought up here again, because again, going back to my own biography, the Situationist International mm-hmm. and the kind of the iconic vision of May of 1968 was fairly important to me. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm wondering what's your critique of that romantic impulse that you see in, let's call it like left artist hipsters in Brooklyn?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that this kind of, I'm interested in these resurgences of romantic tendencies as an antidote to the dehumanization or compartmentalization that happens under capitalist labor. And I think the sort of dangerous thing is that a lot of that rhetoric, because a lot of the counterculture, a lot of the people who have founded Silicon Valley companies came out of the counterculture. They've instrumentalized a lot of the 60s rhetoric into tech utopianism. And so there's this idea that, you know, people like Richard Florida, the creative class, decided, you know, to reinvent the idea of class by saying there's something called creativity that we all have. And if you only just tap into that, all of your problems will be solved. So there's a little bit of this kind of ignorance of real material conditions that happens alongside this idea that, oh, if we only just use imagination, if we only just tap into our creativity, then, you know, we'll have deliverance. And I think I don't have a solution necessarily, but I think there's something in there to note this, the way that rhetoric is used for tech companies or for business now. Apple famously, of course, used that kind of rhetoric. And it's not actually possible for a lot of people to tap into their creativity because they're busy surviving. So I think there's a little bit of magical thinking in that.
Yeah. It's that what color is your parachute approach to life only? It's also like this really naive vision of politics and the economy because, of course, not everyone can run Voodoo Donuts.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Not everyone can create the pizza joint that is going to be the destination spot And there's not just it's not a matter of merit or talent distribution. It's also like those kinds of high-end boutique products can only be sold to a relatively limited class of people. And most of people in a capitalist society have to actually work for fairly low wages just to survive, and they're going to need to have mass-produced products that they can afford.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's the thing. Like, it's a nice idea, but it ignores all of those material conditions, that is structural, institutional material conditions that people can't overcome because they haven't been given the opportunity to overcome them. And it makes it the priority, puts the priority then on, let's just all be creative rather than let's solve some actual, you know, societal inequality problems. So, but I also think it's interesting because it is this kind of utopianist thing that cuts straight across modernism from basically the beginning of the industrialization in Europe. So there's this idea that it's reactionary in a lot of ways, because it says we've lost our wholeness as human beings, which may or may not be true, but now we can't go back to that. So a lot of the romantic movements, like the arts and crafts movement, for instance, wanted to sort of go back to a medieval period when the craftsman was, the lone worker, or there's an idea of a lone worker. But of course, that wasn't what the medieval period was like. Most people were serfs and slaves to the land. So there's always this kind of looking back wistfully at a previous time that never really existed, sort of inherent in the romantic inclination.
Did the arts and crafts movement also pretty much end up getting commodified?
Yeah, definitely. So, started in England from leftist Marxists, pretty strong rhetoric in that anti-capitalist direction. But then when it was taken up in the United States, it very quickly became a style. So like the craftsman style house, the craftsman style furniture, that all, you know, it was sort of, yeah, it very quickly.
That stuff is great stuff. It's like avocado bread.
<know? laughs> Yeah, not saying it's not, but it definitely lost a lot of the radical cultural and economic critique in the process. It just became a style.
The British arts and crafts movement of the late 19th century grew out of the artistic and social activism of John Ruskin and William Morris, who exposed the detrimental effects of industrialization on both art and the lives of workers. John Ruskin was a respected art critic, polymath, and social visionary who became the first professor of art history at Oxford in 1869. William Morris had a more hands-on approach to revolutionizing the applied arts, learning and reviving traditional practices in stained glass, tapestry weaving, printing, and natural textile dyes in his Morris and Company workshops. Both men decried the shoddy nature of factory-produced wares that flooded the already over-decorated parlors of the Victorian period and called for a re-evaluation of what truly constituted a beautiful home. In his now famous dictum, Morris asked, "What else can we do to help to educate ourselves and others in the path of art, to be on the road to attaining an art made by the people and for the people as a joy to the maker and the user? Believe me, if we want art to begin at home, as it must, if you want a golden rule that will fit everybody, this is it. Have nothing in your houses that you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful."
When it first arrived from Amazon, I didn't know what it was. What is it?
You'll see.
Is it for me?
It's for everyone. It's called Amazon Echo.
How's it going?
I'm just finishing up right now.
Is it on?
Oh, it's always on.
Can it hear me right now?
Nope.
It only hears you when you use the wake word we chose.
Alexa.
Well, what does it do?
Alexa, what do you do?
I can play music, answer questions, get the news and weather, create to-do lists, and much more.
Awesome. Alexa, play rock music.
Rock music.
Alexa, stop.
You mentioned in your book that there's something sort of maybe not hyper-masculine, but possibly there's remnants of patriarchy. Maybe I'll be soft about this in the maker movement. Could you go into that a little bit as to how you think it's a kind of a masculine project?
I mean, I think in the educational sphere, there is a desire to have the maker movement be inclusive across gender and race and all of those categories. But I think there is a kind of, the patriarchy kind of cuts through every system in our society. It influences everything. So I don't think, you know, the maker movement has somehow cured that or made it more egalitarian or something.
It's kind of like there's already class worked into the maker movement, so there's also the patriarchal divisions worked into it as well.
Yeah.
And are socially trained maybe to be more likely to take risks, perhaps, certainly they tend to talk over women, like I've been doing maybe a little bit in this.
No, so, and I think.
But did you run into sexism yourself and how deeply into the maker movement did you get?
I think my perspective is as a kind of observer, so I wasn't directly involved with maker fairs or anything like that. But I didn't really run into anything in that particular area personally, but of course, you know, the art world in general is also very sexist. So you run into that everywhere, I think. So one thing that was particularly interesting to me, almost on a kind of like in a kind of poetic or weird way, is this idea of a lot of these artist neighborhoods end up being in former or are still active industrial areas. Like the area in Morgantown still has light manufacturing happening in the area. But I mean, of course, as it develops, that will probably become less and less and less, like Soho and Williamsburg and those sort of places and Chelsea. But I think it's interesting, this idea of occupying the space of labor, like occupying this really symbolic space of labor, a factory building, which no longer exists in the same way in the U.S. So, you know, a lot of that type of manufacturing has been moved cheaper places. And then to kind of take up the mantle or embody this, so to me, it was a sort of idea of like playing house, like playing factory. And so we're going to occupy these factories and we're going to make stuff or produce stuff, or produce products in these former factory buildings. But it's on a kind of it's on the scale of leisure, or to a certain extent, it's a kind of game, or it's a kind of play at it. It's not really production. It's not really being a worker. It's a kind of posture. And I think that
you're not disciplined to produce a mass amount.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't have that kind of, hierarchy or structure. It's a completely different thing, but it's still kind of fun. So there's this idea as well that even, you know, like in Soho, when artists moved in there, it was extremely cheap and it was cheap for many years. In Morgantown, it wasn't really ever cheap, maybe for a few years, but then very quickly people caught on that they could charge large rents, even that far out in Brooklyn. And so it became this kind of thing. Like, I was living in a loft building that when I moved in there, I thought because I was subletting a room from the guy who had lived there for 10 years, I thought it was a relatively stable place. And then I found out very quickly that, you know, it was basically a squat, you know, no heating, sort of open to the elements. I used to sleep with like 3 wool blankets and a hat and a coat. And like, you know, we were constantly facing being evicted, but I paid a huge amount of money to live there. Probably, I'm embarrassed to even say how much I paid to live there. So.
You don't have to say.
So that I thought was an interesting thing that we're, you know, that I kind of happened into this game of we're going to play artists and or we're going to play as workers or, you know, as squatters, but we're not squatting. We're paying a lot of money. So that was one of the things that sort of intrigued me, I guess. About that.
See, I'm just gonna keep doing these little stories from the 90s. I'm sorry. I can't help it.
That's all right.
Because back in the 90s, when I first moved to Portland, my girlfriend and I, now my wife, wanted to move in to an apartment. And we looked at this place called The Lawn, which is in Northwest Portland. Mm-hmm. And it was an old mansion that had been turned into apartments. I was going to say renovated, but it had not been renovated at all. It had run down, and then you could live in the different rooms. And, you know, there was a shared bath and lots of meth on the premises. It was just a shit pile, really, but it was cool looking from the outside.
Yeah.
And sort of the inside was cool, too. And I wanted to live there because it reminded me of Drugstore Cowboy. And, of course, my girlfriend said, "Are you fucking nuts?" And we didn't move in there. Mm-hmm. But I knew people who lived there.
Yeah.
And they were artists and, you know, college dropouts. And some of them worked for the same environmental organization I did. And it was kind of fun to go there and hang out in this deadbeat little place. Now, and really 10 years ago, it is a condominium complex.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's worth like $1 million or something. It's just, it's extremely high end place, and it's beautiful, and it was called The Lawn. And I just think about, were we arriving in a wave of pre gentrification for that neighborhood? Because what happened since I moved there was that the brewery was torn down and turned into a shopping mall. All the former warehouses are now loft apartments. It's the most expensive part of downtown Portland, and it was an industrial area that wasn't particularly safe to walk through in the early 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about that a lot. Like, being an artist, you do, like, you don't have a lot of money, and you do look for someplace cheap to live, but that often means you're the kind of, like, shock troops of gentrification, and you know, even if you don't want to be a gentrifier, you are, because it's your presence in that neighborhood that kind of, you know, quote-unquote sanitizes it for middle-class people to think, oh, well, that's a fun artist neighborhood, and I'm not scared of these middle-class white artists as I am of other people, and think, oh, yeah, then I want to live there and, you know, enjoy the artsy scene or whatever. So I've thought about that a lot, like, when I was living in London as well, because it started, you know, through, you know, I saw, even after I left, all my friends, you know, people were moving to successive neighborhoods further and further east until they're finally just priced completely out of London entirely. So it's and I thought, you know, so artists are in some ways kind of the victims of gentrification, but they're also, you know, pushing it along to a certain extent. And I was always interested in that role, like, what, and from a very personal point of view, that role of, like, so what effect have I had in this, and what is the role of the artist? Because it makes me sad, of course, and it makes lots of artists sad when they can no longer afford to live in the neighborhood that they moved into when it was, you know, rough or whatever. But then they also need to acknowledge that their presence is what has made it that way as well. So yeah, I think it's an interesting issue for artists.
So what are you doing now?
So now I am, I just finished a research fellowship in Amsterdam, and I am now living in Stockholm, just wrapping up my PhD dissertation. I'm just finishing that now. So I'm defending it in a couple months. And then after that, I will be looking for new jobs, I guess.
Is your dissertation connected to this maker movement and your work as an artist?
I mean, it is. Not on purpose, really, but it's about, like, I think I mentioned earlier, it's about art in the squatter scene, a sort of DIY punk squatter scene in Amsterdam in the 80s. So it's sort of, it's related because it's about urban space, technology, the influence of technology, early forms of the internet, and artists and how artists occupy urban space as well. So, so it's related, but in a weird way, I guess, because totally different context. But yeah.